हरिः ॐ
सहनाववतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवासरि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
ओके सो नाउ देयर वर टू हैब्स ऑफ दिस ईटिंग हैबिट्स. So we see as one is basically what are the things that could or could not be eaten. And then the other half is basically how he deals with his sense of security when it comes to food. So then here are certain things that can be eaten. Then it can either be cooked or just ripened. In other words, there are things that can be eaten uncooked. So he either eats things that he gets his grains, he gets these things and that, and he eats them cooked. Or he only eats those things that ripen by time, your fruits or roots or different things that you could just eat without cooking. And then the amount that he keeps. So he says you can keep for a day, month, 6 months, or for a year. The less it keeps, the better it's considered. Just like the brahmana, you may keep for 6 months, you may keep. Problem is the more it is that you keep it, that means the more occupations you have to be doing. Right? It means you may have to be begging, you have to be receiving charity, you have to be gleaning from the field, you have to be doing more things to get that much. Otherwise, just by begging, you're not going to get store for a year. You know? So that means you're spending more time for your security and less time for your reading, your sadhana, your sadhusanga, like this. So if that anxiety is there, then he may keep up to a year. But as time goes and he becomes more comfortable and more detached, then he should start to reduce it from 1 year stock to 6 months stock to 3 months stock. And what's the next? To a month stock to a day stock. Like that. Because then that way, then you're sure that then you're depending upon the Lord. Like that. Even for a Brahmin, he can keep this much, or he can just keep only for the day. So that means if he's made the vow for a day, if he begs or collects or whatever it is, more than a day's worth, he'll give that away in charity. And the next day, then he will again go and collect. So in this way, the idea is to create that mood of dependency upon the Lord. No, right, means any way to get your result, you're dependent upon the Lord. But there's that thing is you're depending upon the Lord to get your result that will keep you going. Or it's just a matter of just what the Lord sends, that's what you take for that day. So it's more surrender. We see in Raghunath Das, he had a good stock, right? His father would send so much gold and so many servants and everything. And then with that money, he would buy prasad, he would feed all the devotees, he would do nice thing, host, and Lord Chaitanya was very happy. Then after a while he gave that up and then went for begging. Right? So then begging then would be a higher thing, because then he's just taking what it is for the day. But by the begging, then he starts to consider, oh, this one gave me yesterday, that one gave me the day before, maybe he'll give me today, like that. So there's all these considerations. Then he took up higher than begging is called ritta, which means gleaning. So then in gleaning, you can glean from the fields, glean from the market, but he went and gleaned from where they throw the old prasad, and that is even after the cows don't eat it. Right? You see around the Puri temple, that the back of the temple, there's a place where they keep all the cows, and that's where all the old prasad goes. So the first thing the cows will eat, and then what they won't eat, then he gleaned from there. So it was actually absolutely, you know, what no one wanted. Rather than just, you know, what wasn't the trouble that someone else would want, right? From the field, you could glean it, or someone else would glean it. Or from the market, you could take it, someone else could take it. It's not enough trouble for the marketplace people. But for other people, here it's like, after the humans won't take it, cows won't take it, then he's taken what's less. So that was like the highest form of this rudita. So then Lord Chaitanya was very pleased.
Like that.
Then, okay, so, yes. Okay. Then his austerities. Let him bathe at the savanas. Savanas means sunrise, midday, and sunset. Many times you see it's referred to when it's dealing with these certain aspects of sadhana, especially the bathing or the Gayatri, especially Gayatri. It will mention in the morning and evening. Because the morning and evening is when one does the full ritual of Gayatri. In the Vedic system, then there's a whole calling of the mantra, purification before, meditation, calling the mantra, chanting the mantra, prayers to the mantra, sending the mantra back. It's a whole, means besides chanting of the Gayatri, it can be like 10 minutes of things. So that's done in the morning and evening. Noontime, it's just the Gayatri is just chanted. So sometimes I've heard of devotees coming across who in the Bhagavatam it mentions, or other scriptures it mentions, chanting the Gayatri in the morning and the evening, and then they think the noontime is unnecessary. But it's not mentioned because it's a simpler form of the chanting. You only chant the mantra. You don't do any of the preliminaries or concluding activities. Does that make some sense? But when it mentions savanas, that means morning, noon, and night, then it's three times. Otherwise, sometimes it just mentions the twilights, morning and evening. Does that make sense? So they refer in the sadhana to twilight, which is morning and evening, or savanas, which is morning, noon, and evening. Just like Trisandhya, also, then, you know, morning, noon, and evening. I think of the spiritual master three times a day.
What's the difference between Sandhya and Savana?
There's none. But generally when they many times just say the morning and evening sandhyas, they don't count the noon sandhya. Savana, I'm not sure exactly what the word means, but savanas refer to those junctures. So those are the three main times when sadhana is done. You know, and in between you work in other things. You know, you take your bath, you do your Gayatri before lunch, after lunch you rest, or, you know, meet people, this, that, and then again in the evening then you start your sadhana and everything. Early morning you do your sadhana, take your bath, Gayatri, study of the scriptures, and then whatever you do during the rest of the morning. So these are junctures in the time. So I'm just mentioning this here because sometimes I've heard it comes up where devotees will see in the scriptures it only refers to the morning and evening. Even Manu much of the time only refers to the morning and evening because that's when you're going to do the full ritual. You'll chant the Gayatri three times a day, but only the full ritual twice. You know, for us, we don't do it with any ritual. We just chant the Gayatri. We don't have all the ritual calling and all that, because our main mantra is Hare Krishna. While for them, the Gayatri mantra is their main mantra, so therefore it's elaborated upon.
So this chanting during morning and evening seems like it's more important than just in noontime.
It's not more important, it's just that you don't know where you'll be at noontime. You know, it may vary, but the morning and evening you're generally going to be at your house. So whatever is your standard regular sadhana, you can perform. But the noonday you may be out at work, you may be traveling, you may be doing so many things and that. So then it's just you take a break, chant your Gayatri, and that's all. But the morning and evening, then it fits within your regular sadhana. Mm. That's the thing. If you have a schedule that your noontime can fit into a regular schedule, then that's very nice. Mm. But if not, at least the morning and evening should be very nicely done, and the noon one, then you fit it in.
Mm. So how one can understand this proper time, fixed time for morning and evening Gayatri?
That's before the sun rises or sets. Mm. Like that. But in some places it gets a little esoteric. It's rising and setting. You know, it's like when you get up in the morning, it's already risen a few hours before, and when you go to sleep at night, it won't set for another couple hours. You know, especially when you get north in the summertime and they go into it. So Prabhupada just fixed it at 6 in the morning, 6, 12 noon and 6 in the evening as a benchmark. I'd like that. So that it's always connected with your bath. So in your morning bath, after your morning bath, then you can chant Gayatri. Mm.
in our situation, so devotees of ISKCON, if somehow one has missed that time,
then you make it up the next time.
Next time.
Yeah, you don't drop it, you make it up. But generally you don't chant in between. You know what I'm saying? If you miss the morning one, then you chant two at noon. If you miss the noon, you chant two in the evening. You know, like that. But it seems that noon can be up to like 3 o'clock. I've heard devotees tell me after a program chanting Gayatri at 3. You know, so basically it's from after your bath in the morning up to like 6. You know, unless the sun rises later. The sun rises 6, 7, 8, whatever. But that's, we're generally up for Mangalarti. So after your bath, either before Mangalarti or just after Mangalarti, and then noon, as close to noon as possible. And then, you know, from noon to 3. And then the evening time, then between, just before the sun sets, you know, up to before you take rest. Also, because we have Pancharatri Gayatris, it's nice if you can do them when during the times when the deities are awake. You know, so you wouldn't get up at, you know, let's say 1 in the morning and then chant your Gayatri then. You'd wait till the deities are awoken at 3:30 and then chant. You know, and you don't do your midnight Gayatri, you know, you try to chant it before because the deities have already taken rest. And that's a Pancharatra consideration.
Excuse me. One more question regarding Gayatri as a personality. So how you can understand the proposition? Who is she as a person?
She's your mother. The guru is the father, she's your mother. Mainly focus on the Hare Krishna mantra as a person. When you get that one down, then the Gayatri mantra's person will be easy.
Krishna mantra as a person is a one person for the whole mantra, or each?
However it comes, however you can focus. You see that it's Krishna, you see it's Radha and Krishna, each word you do like this, each word there's a different aspect of Krishna or Radharani that you're dealing with. I mean, it's just how far you can take it. Because you have name, you have form, you have qualities, pastimes. So in the beginning, you just hear the name. You just hear the sound vibration. Then when you become fixed in the sound vibration, then with time, then the form will come. When the form is fixed, then the qualities will come. Then the qualities are fixed, then the pastimes will come. It's just the natural way you get to know somebody. You've heard about the person. You don't know them, but you can recognize the name. Then if you see them, then the name means that form. Or if you interacted with them, then the name means the form and qualities. And if you've, you know, taken part in bigger or heard about their activities, then the name means the activities, the pastimes. It's just a natural development of the, what do you call it? Relationship with this natural happiness, I think. Okay, then his austerities. Okay, yeah. Making no effort to procure things that give pleasure. In other words, he doesn't go out of his way to get things that procure pleasure. They may come on their own, but he doesn't make any endeavor for that. As a grihastha he did, but now he doesn't. So people bring him nice things, give him nice things, that's one thing. But he doesn't make any endeavor for them. He just endeavors for his sadhana, his scriptural study, taking care of guests, sadhu sangha. You know, these things that are you know, purifying and uplifting. He doesn't bother should be trying to reduce his needs for economic development and for sense gratification. So what comes without any endeavor, that comes. What not, doesn't bother. So if he gets something simple to eat, he's happy. If he gets something more elaborate to eat, he's happy. It doesn't matter. So he shouldn't make that endeavor. So this is the vanaprastha. And from Brahmanas living as ascetics, let him receive alms. So not only just regular Brahmins, but Brahmins living as ascetics. So that would generally mean the Brahmins in the forest or the Brahmins at the outside of the village. Because a forest generally means it's just outside the village. Just outside the village or town or city, you know, there's always forest there. Because in the Vedic thing, you'd have your village, then you'd have a space of cleared land that's for grazing cows, farming like this. Then outside that would be the forest. So then these ascetics, they live just in that forest. You know, so there you can people can go to meet them at the same time as they can go to beg, or they can beg from each other, like this, these kind of things. There's many times somebody gets something, and so then he has something to give. Because their duty still is to give in charity. So anything excess, then they give in charity. So those living as ascetics, then what they have will be considered more pure. Because you're trying to attain purity, so they are pure. Does that make some sense?
You're trying to attain purity.
Purity. So therefore, accepting alms from those who are pure, then you won't be taking on unnecessarily burden of their consciousness, but you'll be purified. Because the materialistic person, then you're taking karma. So if they beg from them, then it takes on for them. When they come to the sannyas platform, then it doesn't matter. But in vanaprastha, then they're trying to get out of grihastha life and focus to come to that platform. Because here it's like they're specifically avoiding the senses, avoiding anything, just staying out, making no endeavor. You know, so it's an endeavor to go away from. Well, the sannyas is a neutrality. They're not interested. They have no need. You understand? It's a slight difference. It's like the difference in the 11th canto, I mean the 12th chapter, 18th chapter of Gita, where Krishna defines the difference between sannyas and renunciation. So renunciation is taking the fruit of your endeavor and then giving that away. That's renunciation. But sannyas means not doing the activity that will get you the fruit in the first place. So then in the impersonalist sannyas means they make no endeavor, or the non-devotional, they make no endeavor for anything. And that way then they fulfill the rule of sannyas, and they don't do anything that will create result. But for the Vaishnav sannyas, then they perform activities for Krishna, for his pleasure. So the activity is not mundane, and the result's not mundane. So this way also then they obtain the platform of sannyas. But in the same way, anyone in any varna ashram can be sannyas by this consciousness. Where are they?
Just sitting in this small pot.
Oh yeah, have them go into the ashram. So that's the thing, is then the sannyas just gives up that endeavor. It means that the vanaprastha is endeavoring to get away from. That's because he's had a need for that, and now he's trying to break that habit of that need for, you know, his dharma, artha, and kama. Sannyas, there's no need for it. So there's neither an endeavor for it or an endeavor against it. You know what I'm saying? The grihastha is endeavoring for it. The vanaprastha is endeavoring to get away from it. The sannyasi is not endeavoring either. Does that make sense? So that's the, we'll see, is the difference between the two. Otherwise they look similar. But one is you're going into the grihastha life and developing. One is you're winding it down. You're doing the opposite. And the other is that you have no need for it, so you don't deal with it. Does that make some sense?
You were describing the Grihastha ashram is engaging the senses, the Vanaprastha ashram is restricting the senses, and the sannyasa is just using the senses to see Krishna.
Yeah. It means everybody, so therefore you can see technically the sannyasa ashram, it means the principles of it, anyone in the Daivavana ashram system can be sannyas. Because technically the Madhyama, if he's properly situated, then their whole mood is Naishkarmya. But they may be working in the realm of Nandriti or Pravriti. It doesn't matter, because it's all engaged in the Lord's service. So the fruit is not what they're engaged in. So by consciousness, they're sannyas, just like as Vaishnavas, they're by consciousness Brahmins. They may not perform the occupation of a Brahmin, but by consciousness of Brahmins. In the same way, everyone in the Varnashram system, when they come to the platform of Naishkarmya, you know, the Madhyama platform, then they may be in any of the Varnas or Ashrams, but they are sannyas. Right? So that's the principle. Then when they come to the Uttama platform, then they're Paramahamsa. So they're just always absorbed in the Lord's service. There's no question of you know, being neutral towards everything. You're just connect. You're just always thinking of Krishna. You know what I'm saying? So because you don't have that dual duty of being neutral to the material world and positive towards Krishna. Because anything you're neutral towards automatically goes away. Anything you're neutral towards automatically becomes inimical. So if you're anything you're neutral towards, automatically the relationship degrades. Right? Means if you're, that's how we got into the material world, is by being neutral towards Krishna. We're tatasta, we're neutral. So we're neutral towards Krishna, but neutrality generally tends towards into being inimical. So we're neutral towards the material world, so that means by nature it's just automatically going to turn into a distaste. It's not a hatred, it's just a lack of interest at all, a lack of any need or any need of connection or anything. You know? So at least, ideally, the minimum is that you don't care. But from "I don't care" means you don't care means you don't want to deal with it. Okay. You know, it's like you'll see the rule is he doesn't want to live, he doesn't want to die. Right? Many times devotees, you know, they're like, "Yeah, we'll live, we'll do this, we'll go on, we'll preach forever." Or it's like, "Yeah, I want to be out of here, I want to get out of here, I just, you know, when's death going to come?" Like this. But here it's like, it's neither. They don't care if they live or die. If they live, they'll serve here. If they die, they'll serve there. But the principle is that they're not at all interested in here, but they're positive. They're interested in the spiritual world. Life in the spiritual world, they're interested in. So they can perform those, that spiritual life while they're here. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Okay. Or he may bring food from a village and may eat 8 mouthfuls. So he may go into the village and he may also
beg, you know, from righteous people and all that, and then eat 8 mouthfuls. So the 8 mouthfuls generally means he's taking that vrata. Chandrayana vrata means it's general principle. It's 8 mouthfuls is a general principle. Is that Chandrayana fasting means that according to the phase of the moon, on the full moon you'll take 15 mouthfuls of food, and then Pratipada will be 14, then 13, then 12, and then Amavasya you won't take any food. Then the next day Pratipada you'll take 1 mouthful, then 2 mouthfuls, something like this. So it's 30 days, and if you add all that up, it works out to an average of 240 mouthfuls. So 30 goes into 248 times. So, like that, that's the principle of that kind of... That's the basic principle, is an average of 8 mouthfuls of food. So you can either just take 8 mouthfuls every day, that's at one time, or you can take 4 in the morning, 4 in the evening... Or you can put it together however you want. The main point is at the end of the month, you've only taken 240 mouthfuls of food. If you want to take all 240 and then fast for the rest of the other 29 days, you can do that also. But the main point is it's... So there's many varieties, how you put the month together.
And this is what, like a rule for a long fast, or is it a special vow?
It's a specific vow, but it's a general principle that they're trying to reduce it down. like that. But it's, you know, all these things are what would be the natural form. So the principle is that he's you know, he's not into overeating anymore. You know, the partying spirit is kind of like gone down. If it's prashad, that's another thing, because you eat prashad, you're purified. You know, like that. But it's a natural thing as you get, you know, you develop, then that's done less and less and less. Otherwise, I always had heard that for the first 6 months until initiation, Prabhupada, encouraged all the new devotees to eat as much as they could. They now kill themselves on prashad, just pack it in. And then after 6 months, then they should try to just eat, you know, how much they need. You know, Sunday they may be a little nuts. You know, slowly, 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 you just start to regulate yourself. So the principle is you should be trying to control.
It could also mean that since he's taking it from the village, then because there's be karma, then he's more careful. Well, if he's taking it from the ascetics, then it's more pure. Then he doesn't have to like that. So it may be whatever is advantageous. He may take from the ascetics, but maybe the ascetics have gone out, or there's not enough, so then he'll take from the village. So then at that time he'll be more careful. Because it may also be what he gets from the village may be more tasty than what's he's gotten from ascetics, so he'll tend to eat more, so this way it will restrict him. I mean, you could see many ways of how it could be beneficial. He must study the sacred text to obtain union with the Supreme Soul. So he should study the Vedic literatures with the purpose of obtaining devotion to the Lord. You may have read them before for karmakanda purposes or whatever his purpose is, but now he should read them for devotion to the Lord. And that should be the principle. And then Mahaprasthana means if he wants to end his life as a vanaprastha, then that's one of the ways of doing it, is just you just walk in a northeasterly direction, only living off of, you know, basically air and water until you just can't walk anymore. Like that. So that's also one of the ways to give up the body. So either in the Vanaprastha Ashram, they can do that, or from this, they perfected the Vanaprastha Ashram, then they go on to sannyas. When the senses are controlled, they're austere, they're simple, they pulled their mind out of the material life, then they go into sannyas. Like that. So either place they could. Like you see the Pandavas, they just walked to the north until they couldn't walk anymore. You say one by one, then they all dropped off. Like that. So only Yudhishthir made it to the top of Gandamandana Mountain. You know? And the dog. So any other questions on this?
Why this direction is chosen?
Northeasterly, because that's the direction of where the water is. So there Shiva stays, Vishnu stays. That's that direction. So in other words, whatever is out is in that direction.
Mm-hmm. So this is from Aryavarta or anywhere one starts?
I guess you'd probably want to go out where it's more of a forest. I don't know if you want to start, you know, in Brooklyn and walk northeast towards, the financial district or something. Is it that way or is it goes the other way? No, the financial district is south. Yeah, actually, it would work because you're starting at the financial district and you're going to end up in Harlem. yeah, you just keep walking through the street. Somebody's going to get you. You know? So I guess you could apply it anywhere. Yeah, okay. Yeah. But traditionally, it means they go out into the forest and they just walk in the forest. They're not walking through towns and villages. You know, if they come across one, they walk around it. You know, it means at this time they're all elder and all that. So it's not that they're, you know, probably going to keep going for too long. But Mahaprasthana is a tradition like that.
Mm-hmm. Vanaprastha,
what exactly refers to? I'm not sure prastha, but it seems to do something with, you know, residing or something. Vanaprastha, one who lives in the forest. It's like Indraprastha, the, you know, place of Indra.
Devaprastha.
Yeah, so it just means one who resides or takes up residence in the forest. You know, like Vanachari. You know, that's the title for Vanaprastha is Vanachari. Like you have Brahmachari or Adhikari, so for Grihastha, a Vanaprastha, it's Vanachari.
And what could be like a recommended path for Vanaprastha?
Prabhupada mentions retiring to the forest of Mayapur Vrindavan. That's certainly what he mentions there. That's one of the things. Other is he mentions them moving into the temple. Means the wife, you know, and the family, you know, wife stays at home, and he moves into the temple with other like-minded men. So that's also, I've seen that written there. So in any case, the main thing is to get into that association where it's the best, so he could move there, or him and the wife can move in the temple, whatever's favorable. So either the temple or, you know, come to Mayapur in Vrindavan. So the idea is to get fully absorbed in good association with this good sadhana, you know, like that.
In the temples, there's arrangements made among sannyasis. They get put into samadhi. If you're in Mahaprasthan, you don't make any arrangement. You just, your body's going to get devoured by jackals or
whatever, bugs. It doesn't matter. There's no arrangement. Sannyasis, that's only if they happen to be staying inside and they don't leave. But otherwise, they live in the forest also. The Vedic sannyasis live in the forest. They can go deep into the forest. While the Vanaprasas, they have to live on the edge of the forest. They have to be... Grihasthas have to be able to get to them. Like that. The sannyasi can go deep in the forest. It doesn't matter. So Vanaprastha, only if he wants to leave as a Vanaprastha, then we can try this Mahaprastha.
And the Ashtanga Yogi is the classic visualization, like in Bhagavad Gita, the goal of the skin. Those are what, Jain, Brahmacharya, Sannyasi, or what? In terms of...
They're more like Brahmacharis. Like that. Brahmacharis, or if they're older, they're more like Vanaprasthas. Sometimes Grihasthas will do it. We see in the Bhagavatam that they would do that. The husband and wife would go and perform the meditation until they got darshan of the Lord. Then they would take up active Grihastha life. So only after seeing the Lord and getting his blessings and coming to that stage of consciousness, then they would do it. But otherwise, if they weren't Grihasthas, generally if they're younger, they're as Brahmacharis, then they take it up. But if they were Grihasthas and started, then they would become Vanaprasthas. But in any case, the Ashtanga Yoga system is as a final perfection, can only be done by celibates. And even if a Grihastha wants to do it to get the Lord's blessing for Grihastha life, he has to be celibate during that time. So it only works because of celibacy. Because if you want to get the semen to the brain, then there has to be some. You know, so that's the principle. Also, if there's distraction, you know, in sense gratification, then the mind won't be able to focus. You can't pull it out. So that's the whole thing, is you get it where it's pulled back out of sense gratification. Once it's pulled out, then so first you're pulling it out, and then you're putting it into spiritual. So that we see also here in the Vanaprastha, he's pulling it out of material life, and then at the end here, then it focuses you putting into the spiritual. Does that make sense? So the first thing is more on getting it out, and then once that's down and that, then he has a lot of time. So then it's just focusing on you know, his devotion to the Lord. Both will always go on, but it's just where the practice is mainly, where it will happen. Okay, then sannyasa ashram.
final emancipation and renunciation. Renunciation. He may live as an ascetic after abandoning all attachment to worldly objects. His conduct and attitude. Reciting texts regarding Brahman and giving a promise of safety to all beings.
So basically, of text, he will specifically focus on those that are transcendental. Those that are directly referring to Brahman. That's why you see the Shankarites as Vedanta Sutra. For us, it's Bhagavatam. Like that. But it's, in any case, it's paravidya, transcendental knowledge. While for the vanaprastas, they will study all the branches, but in connection with the transcendental, because their main focus is on the metaphysics, the esoterics of what's going on. It means they were maybe doing karma and transcendence, but what's the bridge in between, all the metaphysical things on how the one transforms, they transform back and forth from the transcendental, how that's then reflected into the material and then comes, I mean, reflected into the material world in the subtle forms and becomes gross. So from the gross forms, how to reverse that into the subtle forms and back to transcendence. So generally, they tend to study all the scriptures with a focus on the transcendental. But the sannyasis specifically focus on the transcendental. Because the whole idea is that they're supposed to attain to that devotional platform. So for the devotees, then they deal with any scripture, but everything has to be in line with Bhagavatam for us. The study of anything else should be in line with Bhagavatam. Otherwise, it has no particular meaning for us.
And then giving a promise of safety to all beings is that he's for his own gain, there's going to be no violence towards others. So he's going to be very careful not to injure any other living entity. Because the Karmakandi, then they may perform animal sacrifices, you know, as sacrifice or for the Shraddhas. These things may be there. But otherwise, they also have to be careful. Because someone who is kind to all living beings always obtains their goals. Someone who's violent, then they don't attain their goals. So that's always there. Because everybody is Krishna's. How do you say? Dependent. So therefore, if you also are very careful with everybody, then Krishna is pleased. So therefore, whatever you're trying to endeavor for, you always get. So that's why he gives a promise of safety. That's a specific thing. It means in here he has to be very, very careful.
Promise means in this situation something. It's like a vow. He takes a vow.
Yeah, it's just a determination. You know, you don't have to turn everything into ritual, because sannyasa means you're getting away from ritual. So you don't want to then put ritual back into it. You know, like that. But that's the whole point. It just means, that's why it says a promise of safety. It's a sankalpa, it's a determination that I'm going to be non-violent. Like that. You know, but the most important of that non-violent means you're preaching Krishna consciousness. Right? That's the real non-violence. So people are actually safe by connecting to Krishna. So we have to understand is that the sannyas is a material situation in which one can engage one's detachment in the Lord's service. Right? It's just a mundane situation. But it's the one that's least dealing with the material energy. In the way of proprietorship. So therefore then, it's the closest to getting out. But devotion is beyond that. So for us, on all these things, is we have the mundane arrangement, and then we have the devotional aspect. But because we're conditioned, we do have to consider the conditioned nature. Like that. And if one can fully absorb oneself in devotion, then the material considerations are minimized greatly. And to that degree that they're not, one has to consider them, then one is then one engages in those things to connect them to the Lord so you can free yourself from them. Does that make sense?
means we have material desire, therefore we engage those material desires in the Lord's service. We don't have material desire, then we disengage in service. Right? Both you're engaging in service, but one is based on your own desire, and the other one is based on just what is the favorable thing to do. So the one, you'll have your own personal considerations, and then the preaching. While the other one is you don't have personal consideration been reduced, so therefore it's basically preaching. You know what I'm saying? If you have a house to maintain, a family to maintain, then you're going to do that in connection with Krishna. But that's going to take up time. Well, if you don't have them, then you can just engage just straight in the preaching. So then if you have a place, a preaching center and this, you may have the same bills to pay and you have so many devotees inside and you have to feed them and clothe them and take care of them just the same as the family, but it's all Krishna's, it's not ours. So that's the sannyas, is that it's not being done for us. So the grihastha can work in this nishkam, which is recommended, or in the sakam, right? But the vanaprastha sannyas and the brahmachari shouldn't be working in the sakam. They have to be working in nishkam. Brahmachari may be working in nishkam with an idea, I'm going to get into sakam later. You could do that. But the vanaprastha sannyasa has to be nishkam. So vanaprastha is pulling. If he hasn't become nishkam as a grihastha, then as a vanaprastha he should become. So technically he's already nishkam. He can go from grihastha to sannyasa. He doesn't have to go through vanaprastha. Because vanaprastha is for creating that nishkam if it hasn't already been created. So that's why you see for us, many times they go straight from grihastha to sannyas, but they've already proven themselves. If not, then there should be a gap between the grihastha ashram, and then he works on developing that detachment and that preaching and his knowledge. And then when that's situated, then he moves on. Does that make sense? So in other words, all these things is you're trying to get at the mood and the level and the consciousness. And all the externals are simply to help guide that. Does that make sense?
Okay. Let him wander about absolutely silent, not caring for enjoyments. So absolutely silent means no material discussion, and that some may take it as a vrata, mauna vrata, where they don't speak. But the real not speaking is to not, what do you say? Is to not talk about anything mundane. Is to only talk about Krishna. So that's the real silence. Because even the other one is grossly they're not talking, but in their mind there's a lot of noise. You know. But this way, then, in their heart, it's peaceful because it's only about Krishna, and in the speaking it is. Because otherwise, you see, you have these sadhus, they take a vrata mauna, and then they have keep a little chalkboard that they write on, you know. And people respect. Oh, yes, he doesn't speak, but he writes on the board. I remember seeing one sadhu, he wouldn't speak during eating. But he would try by sounds and gestures and eyes to let you understand what he wanted to eat. Right? Rather than go, you know, rice, he'd go, and then you'd have to guess out of the 10 items there which one he was talking about. So instead of just going rice, one word, you know, you'd spend 30 seconds, you know, trying to figure it out. So it wasn't exactly the desired fruit of mauna, you know. So instead of not speaking, he was just making noises. I remember one devotee used to take great pleasure in knowing exactly what he wanted and then giving him something out just so he would make more noises, you know. you know, he was pointing at the cashews, you know, and then he would give him something else that's like simple, you know, like apples, and like just he make all his noises like that. You know, of course that wasn't nice either, but it was really funny because it's unnecessary. Devotees don't make these kind of vows, you know.
Silence just means we don't talk any nonsense.
Fully understanding that the solitary man neither forsakes nor is forsaken.
Means that someone who's alone, he doesn't forsake anyone because there's no relationship to forsake, or nor is he forsaken by anyone. Right? Because otherwise that's the whole difficulty in the material life, is one is either forsaking someone else or being forsaken. Right? That's why material life doesn't work. Is that everybody is forsaking or being forsaken. Even on the subtlest platform, you know. You know, the child wants the mother's attention, but she's busy, so actually he feels forsaken. You know, or the husband comes home, he wants the wife's attention, and she takes it lightly, he feels forsaken. Or she's in a, you know, has some need for, you know, support and all that, and the, you know, husband would rather go do something else, so she feels forsaken. You know, so there's always that aspect. That's just, if you look at it and analyze it, that is material life. There's a few moments here and there where everything went nicely together, but when you go again for that, it's not there. It doesn't exist. So that's, so sannyas means you've understood, there's those few moments where it works, those are just, you know, just maya. And the real thing is it doesn't. You know? So that just takes time and practice, because for unlimited lifetimes we've been going on the principle that, hey, this place is great, you know, and then, and now it's a matter of really taking, you know, hey, you say, grappling with the point is that no, it's not. So therefore he understands the individual is not forsaken nor forsakes anyone. Right? The Gita also makes that point, is that individual soul, because he's not actually the doer, he's not killing anyone or being killed, so he's not the one that's doing, right? So then the sannyasi sees like that, he's not the one doing it, so he's not forsaking, no one's forsaking him, and since he's alone it reduces all that kind of interaction, but in any case he's not forsaking, they're not forsaking, you know? It means Krishna's always there, because the real relationship's with Krishna, you know. That's the real thing. Real relationships with Krishna. Because he's always there. And others are simply used as a medium for that. They are individual souls, so then also we have relationship with them. But still, everything goes back to Krishna. Right? We have, the cowherd boys have relationship with each other, because together then they all serve Krishna. But the purpose is, their relationship with them is Krishna, right? Like that. Or the elder gopis, and their relation is with Krishna, and they do activities with each other and under the direction of Mother Yashoda to please Krishna. So naturally they have relationship, but it's only based on that relationship with Krishna. You know, and because that's eternal, then it's something that's all you can always count on. So no one's forsaken there. So when you get to that platform, no one forsakes or is forsaken. But on the mundane platform, where you don't directly see Krishna in it, then this question of forsaking or forsaken comes in. Because you think it is the wife or the child or the husband or the father or the mother or the, like that. Well, no, it's Krishna. Krishna is just waking you up that these things won't give you. They won't get you. You can't get from it. That makes sense.
He shall be indifferent, resolute, meditating and concentrating on Brahman. So he's indifferent, means it doesn't matter. You know, he gets a nice place to sit down, he doesn't get a nice place. He has nice clothes, he doesn't have nice clothes. He has nice facility, he doesn't have nice facility. So for himself it doesn't matter. Preaching, that's another thing, but for himself it doesn't matter. Like you see, Prabhupada dressed very nice for the preaching and temples and traveling. But when he was alone in Vrindavan, he'd just wear one cloth tied around his neck as a yogi pata. That was it. He didn't worry about nice dressing and stuff like that. You know, he had cloth with holes in it and stuff. But for preaching,
then he would wear nice. So therefore, indifferent, doesn't matter what you get or not get, like the python sadhu. Sometimes I eat nice, sometimes I don't. Sometimes they give me, sometimes they don't. Sometimes I'm fat, sometimes I'm thin. What does it matter? Like that. Resolute, that he's focused. Meditating, that he's always trying to contemplate things, understand how the material energy works, understand the relationship here, understand the connection with the Lord. And so then all this then brings to concentrating on Brahman, means Krishna. So he sees everything in relationship with Krishna, and he sees the material world as functioning all in connection with Krishna. So he's focused on that. Right? He's indifferent to the world, and then he's resolute on what's outside of the world. Right? He's already indifferent to this, so he's resolute on what's outside. Well, the vanaprastha is resolute on pulling himself out of that, and, you know, bringing himself to the point of indifference. That's where his resolution is. So once it comes to there, he can either then go on mahaprasthan or then take sannyas. So that point of neutrality, that's the point he's trying to get to. Let him not desire to die, let him not desire to live. No, because it doesn't matter. His desire to die means that there's too much trouble. Desire to live means there's something to be pleased with. So it's just a matter of, like you see Prabhupada. You know, devotees were asking him, please stay. Oh, that's Krishna. See what he says. It's up to him. If Krishna says stay, he'll stay. Devotees want him to stay. Krishna says, no, you come, then he goes. To him, it doesn't matter. Devotees want him to stay, but for him, it didn't matter. You know, if he can please the Vaishnavas and Krishna is pleased with that, then great. But if not, then... You know. Let him utter speech purified by truth. Let him keep his heart pure. So his speech should be in connection with truth. Truth means the absolute. So in other words, what he speaks should be in connection with Krishna. So that means all what he describes then should be connected in that way. Keep his heart pure, so therefore should not have material desire. His material desire makes the heart impure. And let him patiently bear harsh words. Let him not insult anyone. So people may deal with him harshly, but he shouldn't insult anyone else. Because being insulted or insulting others is a matter of prestige. It's false ego. But if ego is not important, then there's no need of this prestige. Right? So it doesn't matter. You don't mind being insulted, and there'll be no reason to insult someone else. You generally insult someone to increase your prestige. So if you know, you just, how you say, your ego, I mean your feeling of superiority is simply because others are less than you, then you spend your time insulting others to keep yourself in a good position. If you're insulted, then you'll want to insult them back just to bring your position back up. If your insult is better or more devastating than the one they gave you, then it's fine, you know. Like that. Or if it's not, you may end up in a fight and you've got to prove your worth in that way. But the sannyasi doesn't get involved in that. Grihastha is already being careful with that. He's bearing harsh dealings and inappropriate dealings from his family, from his parents, from his relatives, from his, you know, the teacher, like this. He always has to bear that. But now sannyasi expands that everywhere. Because when you're in your house, you're dressed nice, you're dignified, you're from a decent family, all this, so then socially everything will go nice. But as sannyasi, you're wandering around, and you know, the kids, other people, punks, this, that, they give trouble. Like we read in the 11th canto of the Abhantapura Brahman. When he's going out, he begs, he sits down to eat, and he's offering his prayers and that, and all the young punks will come up and take his food or take his danda away from him or even pass urine on his food or, you know, say all kinds of stuff. They have nothing. So it's not like the lower class of society has always been there. Previously, there was a few here and there, but enough to annoy you. Now it's like maybe the general population. But they've always been there. The lowest grade men and all these things have always been there. So whatever is going on now in society has always been there. It's just now it's prominent when before it was just a small group of people. But whatever activities people are doing and breaking the regulative principles, those have always been there. Manu mentions all of them. There's nothing new that's going on. You know, it's thought as something modern, but it's not. You know, I say it's all mentioned by him.
So feeling of being insulted refers to the same category, mental prestige.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point.
I mean, if one has noticed that he has been insulted, means he has the ability to insult others or something like that.
No, it's not matter. The point is one can identify what is insulting, but one doesn't take offense. It's not that one is stupid. One knows what causes insult, but one doesn't take offense. And because of being insulted, one doesn't insult others. You just tolerate, because you just know that it's a material world and all these crazy things happen. People are like that anyway. And we're only going to get what we deserve. So therefore, what can we say?
Let him not return anger. Let him bless when cursed. Let him speak truth.
So if someone's angry with him, he shouldn't become angry back like that. He should bless, because it said if you get angry at the person, then it's bad for them and bad for you. Right? If they get angry or insult you and you don't react, it's bad for them, but not for you. But if they deal with you improperly and you then, you know, wish for their welfare, then it's good for both of you. Understand? They insult you, you react, both of you suffer. They insult you, you don't react, you know, you advance, they suffer. They insult you, you give blessings, then both of you advance, both of you progress. So that's the principle that's here. Let him speak truth. So that means, because truth is always, you know, what's there. So you see, Narad Muni, whatever he would speak would be truth. And even seemingly his curses were blessings. The blessings always put everyone in contact with the Lord and stuff. But it would correct their improper mentality. But otherwise, then, you know, it's just you hope for the other as well. Because the person is only acting badly because of impurities in their heart. So if you wish for their purification so that their heart is pure, then they won't do that anymore. So by your well-wishing, then they're benefited. Anyone when blessing is given on somebody, then it's always for their benefit. It's always for their benefit. And so somebody who's so detached from material energy and dependent upon the Lord gives a blessing, and the Lord takes it seriously. Same time as he may cause some trouble for the person, but that's Krishna's doing. But because they've gotten the blessing, it'll work out nicely.
He shall live in this world delighting in what refers to the soul.
So in other words, what's connected with transcendence, that's how he lives. That's what makes him happy. He lives by that, by the holy name, by the script, by the Bhagavatam, by the Lord's, you know, pastimes, by the association of devotees, by worshipping the Lord like this, his preaching. These are what make him happy. This is what gives him happiness. Like that, not other things.
Let him not seek alms by astrology, giving advice or exposition of the shastras.
So means these things he may do, but he should not seek alms by them. He shouldn't go out and, hey, I can read your palm and then you give money or things like that. He will just preach. He will preach, he'll teach, he'll give advice, he'll speak on the Shastra. But it's in no way for getting money. It's just he's doing that, that's his duty. And then others will reciprocate. However they reciprocate, then that's nice. So that's the point. So for himself, he'll never do anything for that. He may be hungry, he doesn't have something, he needs some clothes. So he won't go and, hey, I'll give some advice, they'll give me some money, or read their palm, or, you know, in other words, he won't do any of these, you know, esoteric metaphysical activities or even straight transcendental for the purpose of getting money. That's not the way he looks at it. Others may look at that. They may expect the sannyasi give so many classes and kirtans and this and that, and then they'll be happy to, you know, pay his ticket or give him a donation. But that's their lookout, you know. That's their consciousness to worry about. But the sannyasi should be doing it because that is his duty. Right? He's supposed to preach. He's supposed to help others. And then they reciprocate or not, that's their problem. You know, they reciprocate nice, they don't reciprocate, it doesn't matter. That's the indifference. But he's not doing it for any monetary gain. Let him wander about controlling himself and not hurting any creature. So he just moves wherever is favorable, and he always keeps himself in control, and he doesn't hurt any creature. He doesn't create any, either by body, mind, or words. You know, it means he doesn't step on the bugs, he doesn't insult people, he doesn't think badly towards people. So on all levels, then he doesn't hurt anyone. And in fact, then he's trying to help them become Krishna conscious. So not only is he just not bothering them, but he's actually brings it to the positive. He tries to give whoever is favorable, give them Krishna.
What about those specific creatures like snakes and scorpions, let's say, like?
Yeah, but he's not going out of his way. He's not walking around with a big stick hunting in the forest to find all the snakes. The point is, if he's walking down the road, he comes across a poisonous snake, he just walks around. He has nothing to do with the snake. If it's found in a place where it may bother people, the snake may be killed, because that's because it may hurt devotees. What kind and I'm just saying, how many snakes have you come across?
In this time, being in my
world. Yeah, I mean, you personally, that you've had to deal with. You've seen, but how many you had to deal with?
No.
Yeah, okay, so you can probably ask all the devotees here, and only a handful of devotees have ever directly had to deal with a snake. Yeah. So that's the point. You ask all the devotees in the rest of the movement and all the sannyasis. So the point is there, but it should not be taken out of balance. It should not be used to negate this point. Like that. If it's in a place where it may bother others, then it may be dealt with. But if it's out in the forest, if that's its blood, what do we care? Just because the Shastras say they can be killed, he lives in the forest. He's not bothering anybody. His vessel shall be free from fractures, so he won't have a bad vessel. Fractures. Vessel. It means like his begging bowl, his lota, and that. They won't be in bad shape. They'll function properly. Like that. You know, also the brahmachari, when his vessels become damaged, he throws them in the water and gets new ones. Well, it's because if it doesn't work, then it'll just be a problem. Point is he's in the world, and what he does, it just works, and that's all. You know, how much he needs to eat, he only eats that much, not more, not less. How much possessions he needs, he has that, not more, not less. So, you know, what he has should work. Like that. It doesn't mean it has to be fancy. It says fractions. It doesn't say, you know, it has to be anything fancy. It should just work for whatever is what he's doing. You know, if he lives in the city, he may have more. If he lives in the jungle, he may have less. like Bhagavatam mentioned, a sannyasi, he can either go in his kopins, you know, or go naked. Doesn't matter. Because if he's in the forest, there's no one there, he goes naked, and the only ones in the forest are going to be, you know, men and animals anyway, so it doesn't matter. But if he comes out into, like, villages and stuff, then he'll wear kopins. Like that. Or, you know, he may wear more. And some of them don't. I think, was it? He always travels with Narada Muni. Parvati. Is he one? He doesn't bother with any clothes. Four Kumaras don't bother. But otherwise, you dress for what's going to be best for your field of preaching. Gourds, wood, or pottery, Mano is declared as suitable vessels for an ascetic. So those are the traditional. Gourds, they have a special kind of lao. It's a squash. And it grows like in a hourglass shape. And so then in the top of the eight, then they cut two holes, and so it works as a handle, and you can fill it with water and everything like that. So Lord Chaitanya used to use gourds. Traditionally we use gourds, and the Goswamis in Vrindavan a lot of times use the pottery. So I think the gourds grow over here in Vrindavan, they don't grow so much, so they would use the pottery. Wood you find more in north, like those from Ayodhya, and a lot of times Rishikesh, Hardwar, they use wood more. Though they also use, or there's a combination, Lord Chaitanya and Puri used to use it, it's a special kind, it's a combination of two. The bottom half's a gourd, the top half's a wood. The top and the handle is wood. It's got a special name. But the bottom's a gourd. Like that. So like that, any combination of that is considered, that's the traditional thing. Metal is not always used because metal takes passion to create. And that problem is nowadays it's very hard to get the gourd, wood, or pottery pots. Before they were very easy to get, like that. Those gourds were common; you could just buy them in the market, you know, or tell a farmer. They knew what you were talking about. You just get one because they're not. You can't buy a fresh one in the market. These gourds means that they dried on the vine, like that. So you have to tell somebody, and then they'll do, or they have them, and then, you know, or the sannyasi will see. Like this, you know, it would be more available nowadays. Very hard to get.
And basically, that's for water.
Yeah, just water and begging bowl. Water and begging bowl. So he can keep he'd keep a kamandalu, have his danda, he'd have a cloth for straining water, he'd have a begging bowl. You know, these would be his paraphernalia.
Is it also like some kind
a
of
a bag?
Is it also some kind of a symbol of sannyas, like danda and this
kamandalu? Yeah, basically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But everyone would have a stick. Brahmacharya has a stick. Grihastha has a stick. But they're just straight sticks. They're not the tree danda. Mm-hmm. That's how you tell the sannyas. But otherwise, the brahmacharya has his brahmacharya stick, and then the grihastha, he has his grihastha stick. Because they're all walking and traveling. You need it for walking, you know, checking things, poking things, defending yourself, you know, keeping away the dogs or pigs. And, you know, all these different things. You know, so traditionally then, brahmacharyas and grihasthas would all have a stick. But it's like a walking stick. Mm-hmm. But the sannyasis would have the tridanda. So. Okay. Any other questions on this?
I've seen in some book mentioned that the tridanda stick is described some way in the Rig Veda.
It's described in Mano also. Yeah, no, it's a standard thing. Sannyas means tridanda. This ekadandi sannyas, this is something that Shankara established. Otherwise, it's not specifically there in the scripture. You may have some reference, but Mano, it's tridanda. His body, mind, and words. So that's the meaning.
Makes sense.
Something more.
Well, I was thinking, I don't know if you bring it up, but the controversy between the Babaji's and the Buddhas and Nyasis from the color of the cloth.
Well, you see, you have four stages of sannyas. You have Kutichak, Bahudak, Parivrajakacharya, and Paramahamsa. So Babaji's just accept Paramahamsa sannyas. Well, Parivrajakacharya's, and they're accepting that level. So for preaching, then the third level is the best, because then you can travel, preach, and like that. It carries a certain kind of, especially for us, kind of institutional mood, and like that. So then they more set example, while the Babaji then is not so much bound by those rules. They can stay anywhere. And this, like, a sannyasi wouldn't so much stay in people's houses for long. Babaji could, you know, because he doesn't bother with these kind of, he just is wherever it's favorable for his bhajan, and that's where he sits down.
Well, just the quote of this passage in Hari Bhakti Vilas, they say never use red clothes, and they take it as saffron.
But red means red, because red is what the tantrics wear. Like, we don't wear red or blue. Blue is what Radharani wears, and red is what the tantrics wear. Red meaning, you know, blood red.
Yeah, so they say red means saffron.
Yeah, well, that's...
So
that's,
we don't accept.
Yeah, but that's their problem, you know. The problem is if they're such paramahamsas, what do they care? If the ignorant walk around in their red clothes and all that, then, you know, you can try to tell them, but, you know, if they don't listen, why make a big stink? But if they're making a big stink, this, that, that's not paramahamsa. Paramahamsa means liberated. So what do they care?
What's
the sense of saffron? I'm not sure. I mean, Bengali is gerwa. But Lord Chaitanya wore saffron. It said Lord Chaitanya's cloth was the color of the rising sun. You know, when it first comes up, kind of that reddish, yellowish, like kind of orange, bright, very bright color. So that's what he used to wear.
Because it seems to, I don't know how it's, is it quoted by already, but they say, Santa Gosain say, always wear white. Vaishnava, always wear white.
That's the tradition, they'd wear white. But for preaching, then, you know, there's no problem in that, because white means is you're not taking any identity. So, because sannyas means there's a prestige to it, you know, because it's the head of the society, this and that. The Babaji's, people may take them or may not, you know, because they're outside of the Varnashram system. So people by Varnashram may not recognize them at all, so they don't pay any attention to them, you know. Then the Babaji's are, you know, happy, because then they don't get any attention. Or they may recognize the saintly people and then, you know, come and surrender to them. And so then that's also okay. The sannyas means is just by the order, then everybody's got to pay attention. So it's specifically only for preaching that is accepted. Like that. So we see that it's there. Vaishnava sannyas is always there. And the other acharyas used it to advantage. And with Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, when he started the institution, then it becomes good. When the Vishva Vaishnava Raja Sabha is very loosely knit, then it doesn't matter. You know, you don't need to have such formalities and stuff like that, because people are recognized by their spiritual merit, you know, exclusively. And people are generally going out to find them, you know. Then, you know, you sit down and you start preaching and word spreads and then things happen. But with Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the Western influence is so great that people have turned away basically from the Vedic. You know, and the impersonalists, and they were very prominent because of their formalization and everything like that, institutionalization. So therefore then he reinstituted it into the line. But it's the same ceremony. There's no difference in it. It's just the only difference is the color of the cloth. Like that. So for us, it's these are minor details. These are these kind of arguments are for people who have nothing to do. You know, have nothing to do. I mean, the amount of time they spend arguing this point, they could have chanted another few rounds. So why bother?
Yeah, why bother?
You know, I'm saying for the Babaji's, why would they get into the argument? You know, because they got better things to do. They got rounds to chant and scriptures to read and bhajans to sing and, you know, parikrams to do. And, you know, it's like, why waste time on this? You know, so it just becomes, these become points of the conditioned souls. You know, their need for religiosity, so then they have to get somehow or another into all these things.
They ask a question out of our discussion.
Not so much here. We're just finishing. Anything else on this?
If you're on the Bhagavad level, then you're still listening automatically. Because we're all mature teams, then we have all of these things spell out.
So it's something for meditate. That's why it says he must meditate. Indifferent, resolute, meditating, and concentrate. So you meditate on all these points. Because then by meditation, you'll start practicing. By that practice, then they'll become habit. And then by that habit, they'll become values. So that's why these things are always studied and discussed and this and that, then these always come up. So if you know that these are the points, then you see in Bhagavatam, it's always talking these points. So those are the points of sannyas, because every Vaishnava is supposed to act on the Naishkarmya platform, that means sannyas. But at the same time, perform their duties. So these exclusively are the duties of sannyas. But these done as your consciousness, and then other duties done in that way, then are the same as sannyas. You know? So that's the whole thing. It's such a perfect system that it can be exclusive, or things can be working in a few spheres at once. They're all compatible. That's why the Vedic system is so perfect, is that you can have multiple spheres functioning in the same place and they don't disturb each other, because they're actually based on all the same principles. That way you can move from one to the other easily. But because the whole point is the consciousness. So if you can affect the consciousness in an early stage, why wait all the way till sannyas before you start having this consciousness? If you can put this in when you're young, then that's all the better. Therefore, you'll see Prabhupada say, you know, our grihasthas are, you know, that better than sannyas, or a person's doing his job, giving his money to Krishna and using it for preaching is better than sannyas. But that means just the ordinary sannyas, just to get out of the material world. It's just to detach, liberate yourself, because the devotee is doing it for Krishna, so he's beyond liberation. So he's already better than sannyas. Same time as there's still a social order, so therefore he respects sannyasis. But he himself may be by his consciousness. But that's just the natural platform of devotee. Devotee automatically is sannyas, because he's not doing anything for himself, he's doing it all for Krishna. So devotee means Brahman, means sannyas. Right? Of Brahman, then the highest is sannyas. So that's the position that the properly situated devotee is anyway. And then whatever varna or ashram he's in, it doesn't matter. So that's difficult, because it's overlapping. So because of this, you have to be able, that's why in Chitta Bheda Bheda Tattva this concept is so important. Two seemingly contradictory points happening at the same time in perfect harmony. That's our philosophy. Right? You know, it's dwait advait. It's this or that. You can look at it both ways. You look at it this way, then you'd interpret like this. If you look at it that way, you interpret like this. No, this is that's happening at the same time. So that's the thing. We're performing the activity of karma, but not for the result. You know, and that is the platform of jnana. That will give you liberation. But that's not enough. We're actually doing it to please the Lord. It's just on bhakti. So we have all these things happening all at once. So when we can accommodate that, then things go smoothly. Anything else? Okay. Om Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.